You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. You know, a year or two ago, I was in Portland, Oregon, and I visited the campus of Lewis and Clark College. A friend had told me about a sculpture by Alison Saar, and I stood there and saw this beautiful, poignant bronze sculpture called York, Terra Incognita. In that sculpture, Saar honors the memory of William Clark's slave, York, who played a crucial role in the Lewis and Clark expedition down the Columbia. The narratives of Alison Saar, an internationally acclaimed sculptor based here in L.A., often celebrate unsung heroes like York. Her work calls on a wide variety of sources, among them slave narratives, African and Haitian folklore, world literature, street and contemporary African-American culture. Her sensual carved figures and installations delve into the universal themes of family, fertility, life cycles, politics, human vulnerability, and hope. Her work is deeply personal, yet deeply informed by myth and history. Alison grew up here in Los Angeles in an artist's family. Her sister Leslie is a painter, her mother Betty Saar, an acclaimed mixed media artist, her sister Tracy, a writer, and her father Richard Saar was a ceramicist and art conservator. Alison is the recipient of many awards, including a Guggenheim, and her work has been exhibited at museums throughout the United States. And her work is on exhibit now through October 5th at L.A. Louvre Gallery in Venice. We want to thank L.A. Louvre, especially Elizabeth East, for help in facilitating this evening's program. Tonight, Alison will discuss her own artistic practice with African art scholar and curator Polly Nutter Roberts. Roberts is a professor in UCLA's Department of World Arts and Culture and consulting curator for African art at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. She served as senior curator at the Museum for African Art until 1994 and deputy director and chief curator at UCLA's Fowler Museum until 2008. Together with Alan F. Roberts, who's here tonight, she produced the award-winning works Memory, Luba Art and the Making of History, and A Saint in the City, Sufi Arts of Urban Senegal. Tonight's conversation is titled Body Politics, Art, Identity, and Memory. Please welcome Alison Saar and Polly Nutter Roberts to the Los Angeles Public Library.
We're so delighted to be able to be in conversation tonight. Alison and I have a history of conversing. We've worked together ever since the year 2000, right, when we did an exhibition together at the Fowler Museum that Louise mentioned, Body Politics. The Female Image in Luba Art and the Sculpture of Alison Saar. This was the book accompanying that exhibition. It was just a fantastic chance to have an intellectual and also a very personal dialogue.
Very much so, and I think, you know, it's funny because we knew of each other before we actually met. I remember seeing your African Arts Secrecy show. Mm-hmm. I may not have the title right, but so I was really admiring your work then, and then you capped upon my work, so we came together, and our first conversation was basically what ended up being the catalog for this,
right,
for this show. So
our first conversation was in our kitchen.
It was great.
And actually, that will prove to be symbolic later as we begin to look at the images, but we'll tell you a little bit about how we got to know each other through each other's work before we actually got to know each other in person. And we'll just start with this fantastic image, bain froid in French, cold bath, right?
Yeah.
It's just a wonderful sculpture from both front and back. That was the opening piece of Body Politics, the exhibition at the Fowler Museum in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. And maybe as a lead-in to our interest, our mutual interest in concepts of secrecy and whatnot, maybe we could just begin by looking at this piece together and thinking about how it speaks to you as audience members, perhaps without really knowing much about what was intended, and then what else is going on under the layers of meaning embedded within this work.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's what's really interesting for me as an artist, to kind of, you know, take a piece to a certain point, and then, you know, I've kind of see it as a collaboration with the viewers, and that they bring their own history and their own experiences to the piece, and that piece will be a little different to each person because, you know, they're going to interpret it in different terms. So, you know, I kind of see that the divide between art and illustration in some ways, that, you know, that it's a collaboration with the viewer. So.
Well, when we talked about this piece, I remember you telling me a little bit about how perhaps on the surface one might look at Bain Froid and think of, say, a painting by Gauguin,
right? Right, yeah.
And maybe see a kind of romanticized, feminine, voluptuous female figure.
Right, very much this sort of, almost, you know, the viewer as voyeur.
Right.
You know, that she's here doing something very private. She's taking a bath. She's taking a cold bath of cold water, so it really talks about, you know, her social status in terms of not having hot running water, sort of thing. And, you know, again, kind of thinking, oh, isn't this quaint? But the reality is that she probably would prefer a warm bath in the bathtub as opposed to, you know. So again, it's this kind of like, you know, invasion of this privacy sort of thing. So it's kind of, you know, a political retort to that work.
Right. Yeah. So it's kind of that sense that on the one hand, as a viewer or a voyeur, as you say, you might see this romanticized image of a woman, but underneath there are the sociopolitical realities of her real situation, and that is not necessarily easy. Are her lips blue?
Her lips are blue, and actually her skin is blue as well. I use copper in a lot of my work, and so, you know, and so that natural patina of it really kind of went along the lines with that, you know, she's freezing in this cold bath, and she's wants to get out of there as soon as possible.
Right. So that kind of idea of exterior, interior tension and dimensionality is partly what you told me in a conversation attracted you to the exhibition Secrecy, African Art That Conceals and Reveals that I had curated in New York City for the Museum for African Art, which you saw?
Which I saw. I mean, I didn't know anything about you. And, you know, I had gone to the museum before, you know, they have amazing exhibits. And so, you know, I just, and in particular, this piece, I remember, you know, where you pull the plug out of the ear and you speak into it, right?
Is
that how it works?
Right. So, I mean, throughout this conversation, in a few moments, we're going to show some African sculptures, not necessarily because you're directly inspired by those very pieces, but maybe just because there are certain kinds of ideas that resonate through certain forms of African art and many of the themes of your work. So these are two of the figures that were in the Secrecy exhibition. And the idea of the Secrecy exhibition was really that a secret is always a paradox. It's always a paradox of both revealing and concealing, because we cannot know that there's a secret unless it announces itself. But it isn't a secret unless it's kept from us.
Right, yeah.
So when two people are whispering over on that side of the room and you're left out of that conversation, we know that a secret has been announced, but we don't know the contents.
Right, you don't have it.
Right.
Accessibility to it, right.
So the piece that you had alluded to when we were talking the other day that had had an effect on you, an impact on you, is the work on the left-hand screen, which is from the Fon people of the Republic of Benin, and it's called a Bochio figure. And a Bochio figure is a therapeutic figure whereby a person who's ill or who is suffering from certain kinds of problems will go to a healer and commission a sculpture, which is then consecrated, and certain attachments and accumulations are added to the surface, and the problems of the individual are whispered into the ear of the figure and then plugged.
And plugged up.
Right.
Which I love. And I, you know, I mean, you know, and a lot of my work too often has these sort of windows or interior sort of things too. So this sort of,
yeah,
that there's something within, and again, and it's kind of ambiguous as to what it's all about. So it is
right.
a certain amount of secrecy in that respect. Yeah, yeah,
for sure. The piece on the right is just another example. It's a Yombe power figure. Some of you may be familiar with these figures that have cavities mm-hmm. in the stomach, and you might keep that in your mind's eye because we'll see some of that in some of Allison's work later on as well. Mm-hmm. But the interesting story about the piece on the right is that it's from the Munich Museum for Völkerkunde. And at one point, they decided to X-ray the piece. They wanted to know what was inside because, after all,
crying eyes.
The Enlightenment has told us that we should always know, right? And be clued into whatever it is that is, you know, seems to be sacred or arcane knowledge. But when they X-rayed the piece, all they found were layers and layers and layers of cloth within those red rolled elements on the surface. And within those, there were some reeds, but the reeds were also circular. And it was like peeling away the layers of an onion.
Layers of an onion, right.
Or pulling out Chinese boxes. There was really nothing precisely at the interior.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Although undoubtedly there would be in the stomach cavity.
In the stomach thing, yeah.
And we'll probably come to that in some of your work.
Okay.
So this interiority and exteriority and the tension between them characterizes so much of your work. I want to just say that we're going to lead up to the remarkable works in the exhibition right now at L.A. Louvre in the Sloth exhibition. And but we wanted to start with some earlier work. And because Allison is so prolific and has done so much work, we're really focusing on the female image tonight and
right.
focusing
Sorry, guys.
on body politics. And I think that no matter who you are, what your interests are, you'll find that there's a remarkable story here. These, like Louise referred to, are really narrative devices. So tell us about Sweet Thang.
Well, Sweet Thang was a piece that I did. I moved to New York in 1982 and was fortunate enough to get a studio at the Studio Museum in Harlem, which is really great. But coming as a girl born and raised in Laurel Canyon, which is very, you know, quasi-rural, and to be smack dab in the middle of the city and even better yet to be in Harlem, it was kind of startling. It was, you know, a bit of a reality check for me. And so I did this piece, Sweet Thang, and she's kind of being sassy. She's kind of got one end of her skirt hiked up and her hand on her hip. And then, you know, the thing is that you go from this face and then your gaze goes down and you see that her feet, she's standing on glass and that she's bleeding by her feet in this broken glass.
Mm-hmm.
And it really talks, you know, testifies to the strength of these women that, you know, have to endure a lot of stuff. You know, some of them are, you know, having to, you know, do whatever they can to kind of just make a living and to survive. And so it's really about surviving, and sometimes you have to do some horrible things to survive, but, you know, just still have that sort of personal strength and integrity. So that was.
And the thing that's so amazing to me about this piece, which we included in Body Politics, is that when you first look at it, you don't see the glass right away or the bloody feet. You just see this coquettish woman, you know, and just such a sort of like spring-like dress. And it gives you a completely different feeling. And then as your eyes move down the figure, you just begin to get like something in your gut, you know, that you realize that this woman has endured so much pain and suffering. And yet she's standing tall and proud.
Right. And that, you know, she's just does it.
Yeah. So a lot of the work plays with that duality. How
yeah,
about this
a lot of
particular
outside and inside,
yeah.
and, you know, strength and vulnerability, and, you know, a lot of it, some of it's political, some of it's very personal. This piece is called Sapphire, and it's the same thing, and we don't have a closed version of her, but she's rather well endowed, and the idea being that the viewer comes and actually has to grab her by her breast and open it up, and so she's kind of confronting him, saying, you know, I dare you to kind of go beyond this and see who I am inside.
Right.
And all of the pieces are actually just bits and pieces of, you know, actually there are things that I would pick up to and from going to the studio. I lived in Chelsea at the time and, you know, going up in the little things came out of the gutter and whatnot. And that kind of makes me think of the piece that we were just talking about, you know, these things that, these objects that don't really have any apparent relevance or any real importance, but that, you know, that they have a sort of a history and a past to them, and that they've been handled and broken or whatnot, but that by bringing them together and gathering them together, they take on a sort of meaning and an importance. And so this is just like everything red, and it's just about passion.
So the breasts, if you look carefully, there are all these tiny objects attached to the interior of the body.
Right,
and this cavity that really is so much like that Yombe power figure that we were just looking at from
I think a lot of that came from, you know, when she mentioned earlier that my father was an art conservator, and one of the things that I was able to do was work on African art while I was there, and it kind of really got my interest in it as well. And one day a piece came that had a little gourd belly that had been broken open.
And so
all of a sudden I could see all the secrets inside. I'm sorry, I've got my back to you all. And so it was a little unnerving because I knew this was something that was not meant for my eyes.
Right.
And so the whole time putting all these things back together. And one little thing, I don't know if it's part of an insect or something, but it looked like a miniature skull. I'm just like, whoa. So I just kept on saying, I'm putting you back together. Don't mess with me. I'm not prying, sort of thing. So I think that really kind of influenced this idea of, you know, what can be inside and secret things inside and things that seem to have no apparent sort of importance, but do that by placing them in there.
Right.
And whatever ritual put them in there, and whatever history those little bits and pieces had, give them power.
Right.
Right.
I like the way you describe them as having history, because also when you look inside the power figures of Yombe or Congo peoples in Africa, these shards and bits and pieces and fragments of things from nature or from whatever it may be, claws or a bit of bark or a chip from a blind man's staff. Every single thing is a fragment that is a part for whole and that stands for something greater than itself.
Right.
So, for example, the chip from a blind man's staff could stand for insight. They may just seem like bits and pieces, but brought together, it's kind of like we're seeing into the interior world of this woman's life.
A little cosmos,
A cosmos. That's a beautiful way to put it. So, and this idea of inside and outside is something that you told me that you encountered with regard to African art very early in your career.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Allison and I have something really interesting in common.
Special in common.
Very, very special. Which is that we both went to Scripps College. We did our undergraduate degrees at Scripps College, Claremont Colleges, and we had the same mentor, Samela Lewis.
Many of you know Samela Lewis. She's phenomenal.
Phenomenal woman. And we were 2 years apart. Allison was...
So we never met. Right.
Right, right. But only later did we discover this. But you told me a story about something you encountered.
Yeah, within the collection, they had a Ileore, which is a little cap that was all... It's covered in cowrie shells, right? And it's Yoruba.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this notion that of, as I understand it, you probably can give a little more insight, you know, of the house... The head as a house, and that all these things kind of function within this little crown. And so I was really intrigued with that. And I think, you know, again, a lot of the kind of interior, exterior elements to my work kind of it was influenced by my study for African art working with Samela Lewis.
Right. And so we didn't have a photo of an Ileore, which is called by the Yoruba of Nigeria a house of the head, which is this leather encasement with cowrie shells that really is a shrine to one's wisdom and to one's personhood. But what we thought would make a really nice parallel was to show you an image of a Yoruba king wearing the crown of power, because the crown of a Yoruba king is always beaded and veiled. Veiling the individual features of the king, because every king should only be the culmination of all the kings and all the ancestors who have come before. And so it's paying homage to the deities that are represented on the upper registers of the beaded crown, but without bringing too much attention to this particular ruler himself. So there's this interplay of inside and outside and exterior, interior, that's very much rooted in that notion of the house of the head. Oh. And so the Yoruba have this concept that we both are familiar with called the inner head and the outer head. And there's a Yoruba proverb that says, may my inner head not spoil my outer head. So we all have our deepest interior thoughts, and we also have our public personas, and we always pray that we're not going to damage our exterior persona by the thoughts or emotions or experiences that we may be really having or feeling. So that that expression and that notion that there's this two-sidedness of identity permeates Yoruba religion and Yoruba cosmology and worldview, and it permeates the sculptures of Alison Saar.
And I guess, you know, I always see it as this sort of duality that, you know, you assume you see one thing and the reality is something else or something more enriched. And I think, you know, part of that comes out of my own personal sort of heritage. You know, I'm half African American, but I look very white. And so that has always been, you know, this sort of thing that I've had to deal with, that, you know, I'm always perceived of as white. And then, you know, that duality also kind of also plays into this sort of animal self and civil self, like the inner head and the outer head, you know, the one that we present and the one that we're be seen and recognized as, but who we are inside, which is sometimes a little spooky.
Yeah.
So,
well, when we said that we both met each other before we really met each other, the place where I really met you before we got together in our kitchen was at the home of Richard and Jan Baum, who are here in the audience.
Hello.
And where I first laid eyes on this remarkable work of art that is on the screen right now, which is called Chaos in the Kitchen. And Alison, I wonder if you could share with us, this is monumental. Oh, it looks pretty monumental up there.
Yeah,
it's
all big.
It's larger than life, and it is an extraordinary work of art. And actually, Jan Baum was so instrumental in helping us when we were creating Body Politics, the exhibition, in helping to procure loans for the exhibition and the amazing works that were in it. But Chaos in the Kitchen is on the cover of the book, and her hair is on the back. And I wonder, we don't have a back view of her, but can you tell us a little bit both about the punning on the title, because you use titles so amazingly well in your work, but also what's going on in that head of hair?
Well, I mean, I guess first off, to start with titles, you know, a lot of the work is kind of heavy. And so I always try to give it a little bit of levity. And I'm really interested in how, and I think that's something that actually came through the diaspora, that, you know, this sort of idea of dealing with political issues and, you know, and just oppression and things like that, and how in levity and music and theater and satire that somehow you can talk about these really heavy, intense things with a little bit of levity. And part of it was to kind of veil it for the white community so they wouldn't recognize that you were kind of having a political discussion.
Right.
And part of it is just to kind of, you know, I think insert a little bit of hope. And how you can kind of overcome these things. So you hear that a lot in the blues. And so, you know, the blues are very much instrumental in the titling of my work and even some of the ideas of the work. And so Chaos in the Kitchen is just kind of goofy. And for those of you who don't know, kitchen is that curly, nappy bit in the back that, you know, kind of lose the teeth on your comb, trying to comb out sort of thing. And so for this case, you know, I love this idea, and you'll see it over and over again. And it actually is one of the threads that we have between the Luba work and my own work and other African works, in that, you know, for me, the hair, maybe because my hair is maybe the only evidence of my African-American heritage as well, that it kind of becomes a sort of biographer. And so in this case, she's got this hair, looks a little fried, she's maybe been trying to straighten it a little too much, but, you know, she's got, like, a winged victory in there, and I think there's like maybe a boat for escape, and you know, just different objects that really kind of give testify to not only her past and her present, but her aspirations and her future. Mm-hmm. So,
is this the one with the Eiffel Tower in it?
I think there might be an Eiffel Tower in there. Everyone needs an Eiffel Tower, and actually, what that part of that comes about, you know, as being a sculptor, you know, I would be carving, and then, you know, I'd have like a lovely, you know, evening dinner with somebody's clients or whatnot, and, you know, chunks of sawdust would be falling out of my hair into my soup, and it would kind of testify to kind of what, you know, whatever I was doing in the studio that day as well. So I kind of had this, you know, notion that it kind of carried a truth to it.
I remember you telling me one time your mother would kind of threaten you about combing, you know, your
she
hair
denies
or
that.
It would turn
she's
into
not here
a
tonight,
bird's
so
nest.
We can just yeah, and that if she said bird's nest, I thought she said rat's nest. But if you didn't comb your hair out, things would start living in it. So
yeah. So we're going to see another example of one of Allison's hair pieces.
Right. This one's easier to see her stuff. Well, she's got a monkey wrench. This is Nappy Redhead. So, yeah.
And a basketball player. And
there's a winged victory in there. Yeah. And a canoe.
So in a way, the hair is similar to the opened chest with
right.
all these
right.
secrets and dreams and, as you say, hopes and aspirations.
Yeah, that they kind of chronicle.
Memories.
You know, and her identity is kind of being revealed through her yeah. hair. Yeah, yeah.
So the thing is that hair and, well, all the aspects of the female image that Allison is so interested in are equally interesting to me, especially in my work on art of the Luba peoples of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is what is on view right now at LACMA in the exhibition Shaping Power, which I hope you'll all have a chance to yeah, see that beautiful. Has inaugurated a new African art program at LACMA. Mm-hmm. And there are some really beautiful works on display, but one of the things that you notice about them right away is the importance of hair. And the Luba were so famous for their hairstyles that early explorers dubbed them the headdress people, because the hair was a mark of identity. It could tell you a whole lot about a woman's past or her about her present, about her identity, about her family, her clan, whether she was married or widowed, or even male hairdos about their professions, if they were fishermen, if they were farmers, if they were blacksmiths. Mm. And also sometimes you would find that things were embedded in the hair. And there's a piece in the Fowler Museum where you can actually see a red packet of medicinal substances implanted in the
there.
Back of this kind of cross-shaped coiffure that was a very, very popular style in the 19th century. And here's another piece.
That
this one is at LACMA. It's a royal cup. It's actually used for libations and for drinking palm wine on the occasion of a king's investiture. But what's extraordinary here is just the monumentality of the hair itself. And the fact that Luba people say that it looks like a woman, but kings were known to don a woman's hairdo on the day of their investiture. So
that's
one can't
cool.
be absolutely 100% sure what gender it is, but it is a reference to the power of the hair and the head.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see that so much in your work.
Right. This is the hairball. But this piece titled Cash, you know, this, you know, she's kind of dreaming and this long hair that, you know, has been wrapped and rolled and rolled and this notion that there's something inside of that. And so, again, it's about secrecy, but it's also about her history is kind of rolled up in that as well. And what it is like miles of baling wire wrapped yeah. around and around and around again. And then, you know, and then I'm really interested in, because you mentioned that the cup was used for libations.
Right.
I've always loved that sort of patina that things get by being rubbed and caressed and the accumulation of you know, of course this drives museums insane because I always want to go in and put some libation on it myself, lay some palm oil, literal palm oil on it. But, you know, so it has these layers of tar that have been worked into the wire and things like that. But, I'm really interested in kind of the piece after it leaves the studio,
right.
accumulating the experience by those that come view it and participate with it and that everybody brings a little bit of themselves to it as well.
Yeah. So this piece really transitions us into another aspect of the hair that really, really gets at aspects of your identity.
Right, right.
And these are two examples that play off of each other really nicely.
Yeah, and they really talk about, you know, sort of my biracial makeup and kind of what that's, you know, meant to me. And again, when I was talking about my hair being my only sort of giveaway, if I were passing, you know, I'd be straightening it, but I have relinquished to it. And so on one side is dark roots, and so it is, they're kind of conjoined twins joined by their hair.
On the right.
Right, yeah, I'm sorry, I got flipped. And so the figure down on the bottom is covered in kaolin, like a white chalky surface. And then the figure on top is covered in tar, and she's been sprayed with a solvent. And so the tar kind of goes down and stains the bottom figure. And the same with the piece Taint. And the title Taint is because she taint black and she taint white. She lies somewhere in between. And then, of course, you know, I'm really big on puns, and so also taint in terms of her being tainted. And so those are actually physically roots that have been covered in tar. Mm. And the same thing with her is that she's this kaolin surface that's been stained by her hair. And, you know, if she were trying to pass as white, she would be betrayed by her hair. And so it's kind of playing off of that. But for me, it was always, you know, the one exterior sort of connection that I could make with my cousins and everything else. We all were, like, you know, messing with hot combs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then again, she's got these blue lips, these blue copper lips. And you'd ask what that's all about. Yeah. And it's sometimes, you know, and we're both using a lot of hand speak, but, you know, there's kind of parts of the body that are receptive to information, receptive to things coming in and things going out. And so the mouth, the eyes, and the hands are really important in the work. And a lot of these have no eyes whatsoever. If I'm trying to influence, I mean, emphasize the mouth or the palms of the hands. But, you know, I usually have those things be different colors or different materials. So in this case, she's got these blue tin lips, or copper lips,
copper.
I should say. Yeah.
And this, the works are made from wood and then tar.
They're carved in wood, yeah.
And then the roots.
Yeah, and I usually give them a covering or a coating of some sort.
Right.
So they have it.
And actually, we're going to transition into that idea. We're going to transition now from the hair to the skin, because the skin plays such an important role in your work, and also in the work that I do on Arts of Luba Peoples, where scarification patterning is so important to identity. And you can see from this throne of a king that's on display at Lakma right now that the torso is completely covered with these beautiful, they are marks of beauty and identity, marks of civilization. They're like tattoos, but whereas tattoos are flat on the surface of the skin, scarifications create a welt on the surface of the skin that is tactile to the touch and that is like a bump on the surface that is both erotic and beautiful, but also really says, I am Luba, and maybe tells you even more about a woman's biography, a little bit like writing a biography on one's body.
Yeah.
And that really resonates so beautifully with Sledgehammer Mama and a whole series of works that you've done where you begin to give your works a skin.
Skin, right. And then, I think to go back to the Luba piece, I love that it's almost like this braille.
Yeah.
And you were saying how it's erotic. You could read this figure, this person's story in the dark, which I think is really beautiful.
That's a beautiful concept.
And so I started using ceiling tin. I moved to New York in 82. And when I was up in Harlem in the 80s, everybody was pulling all their stuff and doing all this massive renovation. And so I had access to all these amazing materials. And one of them was ceiling tin, which we don't really have that much out here. But it was great because some of it dated from the turn of the century. And I also used a lot of linoleum, too. But I think what was really special for me about the material was I think it was, you know, my late 20s at the time. And I felt like I really wanted to talk about things that were really deeply imbued with history. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have that history. I didn't have that experience. And so, you know, the ceiling tin, some of it, you know, it had been looking down for, you know, some of them almost 100 years. Mm-hmm. And whether, you know, they would see people eating or people dancing or people making love, babies being born, people dying, that they had this sort of, they were witnesses to all this history. And chronicling it, I imagine. Mm. And so I felt by bringing that to the piece that it gave the piece certain wisdom, that it kind of, that they had a power, that they had accumulated this power of this history. And so in this case, you know, I would often, you know, cut the pieces and kind of arrange them symmetrically so they kind of created these sort of symmetry patterns. Here's a close-up of the tin. And part of the process I really like, it's... And so I work with assistants usually when I do this thing, because the carving I do on my own because I can't really I don't feel comfortable handing my chainsaw off to anyone. But when it comes to, it becomes this sort of quilt making process, and it becomes this kind of small community process. So we're all like, and every once in a while we'll get into this rhythm, and it starts, you know, we're hammering the nails in and things like that. And we start getting this kind of tip tap
really
thing going on. And so it's another aspect to the work. And I think, you know, for much of us as artists, we're, you know, in the studio solitary. Mm. And so it's kind of a neat way to kind of bring other people into it too. So yeah. I really love that aspect. But they're, you know, on one hand, they have this scarification, they kind of talk about this history, but it also creates this sort of armor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, that these pieces, they're, you know, they've endured so much, they've been vulcanized,
yeah.
you know, that they have this sort of hardened exterior through enduring, you know, whatever hardships and difficulties. And then, you know, it creates this exterior. And so then, you know, the viewer is then invited to somehow understand and experience what her interior is and what her ideas are and her emotions within that.
Yeah, there's a quote here, but I didn't bring my glasses, that you said about Sledgehammer Mama, which belongs to LACMA, by the way, that with her kind of physical strength, she is forging her place in society, and she's able to punch anyone's lights out.
I'm into tough girls. I know. I was kind of like, I wouldn't say I was a bully in the neighborhood, but no one messed with me.
Well, with the chainsaw, I don't think too many people would. Anyway, one of the terms you've often used is this wisdom of the materials, this idea that they themselves hold this memory, these memories mm-hmm. and histories mm-hmm. within mm-hmm. themselves. It's such a fantastic concept. And not only do you use the ceiling tin, but you also use copper rupuse, right?
Right,
and
yeah.
So this is this phenomenal, monumental sculpture of Allison's called Scar Song.
Scar Song. And, the idea, I mean, I think we all have, you know, scars, and we know exactly where they came from when you're hopping the fence when you were, you know, 5 years old and when you fell off your bicycle and all these things. Yeah. And so I liked the idea. And, you know, it was really interesting to realize that, you know, the scarification was yeah. also kind of followed along the same lines, that these sort of histories could be read off of her body. And so the copper rupuses are just found things. You've seen those, you know, you made them in Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts where you did like little drawings of things and then you put it on copper and you nail it up on your wall sort of thing. So I just gathered these from all over the place. And some of them, you know, like here's this beautiful African woman's face on the side. I found a really beautiful bunch of grapes, which I put over her pelvic area, so she, you know, her little delicacy. So again, that you could kind of tactily understand and feel and understand her experience.
So this was a whole period in your work where you were giving this armor to these figures. And this is going to be important later as we move in the next few minutes through some of the trajectories that you've taken. But again, just to show how incredibly interesting it is vis-a-vis mm-hmm. these Luba mm-hmm. objects, it's just a chance to show you another scarification-laden figure.
That's
and
so
then
beautiful.
A detail of it. And every single pattern is named and has some set of meanings, mm-hmm. and their juxtapositions mm-hmm. tell stories. And when a woman has a baby and the scars retract, she has the option to add more after childbirth.
Cool.
And so over the course of your lifetime, you accumulate more and more and more until your body reads like a text.
Hmm.
So it's pretty like writing amazing. Your autobiography literally on your skin. So I really just wanted to be able to have a chance, since we're at this amazing, remarkable library, to show this object that's also on display in Shaping Power that connects to all these things we're talking about, because this is a memory device. It's called a Lukasa memory board from the Luba people of Congo, and it was a device used by court historians over several centuries to hold the knowledge of the Luba past and to be able to stimulate oral recitations, long, very complex speeches that were stimulated by the bumps that you described mm-hmm. as being almost mm-hmm. like Braille. Mm-hmm. And it really is, because they'll hold these boards in their hand that depict women's bodies.
Mm.
And so there's an allusion to scarification. There's even an allusion to the to breasts, a whole row, the row of wooden bumps across the top is actually considered to be a row of breasts. And on the back, it's also a tortoise. So there's a kind of armor on the back.
Oh, right.
There
are
incised patterns that are meant, they take the name of a scarification pattern that really is all about holding strength within the body and locking it within. It's this wonderful, incredibly interesting object that serves as a library of Luba knowledge. It's so multi-layered and so infinitely complex that it can keep leading you to deeper and deeper and more, you know, more complex layers of knowledge.
What I also like about it is it's, on one hand, it's almost like a physical landscape and a map of space, but it also that it's a map of time and experience, which I think is really, unless I'm misinterpreting
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it literally is.
Really is.
There are so many meanings embedded microcosmically to macrocosmically from a tortoise to a woman's body to a king's compound with his palace, an architectural blueprint, and then finally to the entire Luba landscape.
Right, yeah.
So it literally is mapping all the sacred locales in the landscape,
which I think is so amazing.
It's also on a woman's body. So within that body is also the body politic.
All of those things are contained. Yeah.
So that's where the two concepts really truly merge
come
and blend
together.
And come together. So that leads us to an even more specific iconographic motif that permeates your work, or at least that is characteristic of a certain body of your work.
Yeah, the breaster. I'm a big breast girl. So this piece is called Suckle, and it was actually directly inspired by the granary doors of Mali, where you'll often see a door and it'll have a set of breasts on them. And maybe not fully understanding it, but this idea of women as protectors and nurturers and, you know, feeding, not only the physical feeding, but also just kind of, you know, in embracing a community. Mm-hmm. So this is a community of frying pans. They're all different cup sizes. They were actually cast from actual frying pans, which I had gathered, and they are beautiful because they have, you know a fine frying pan when it has all the crusty grease on the outside, right? And no one's messed with it. Nobody's like scrubbed it with the Brillo pad or anything. So they would have these beautiful, and you know, and people hand their frying pans down, you know, from family to family, that, you know, you have your great grandmother's frying pan if you're lucky. If you played your cards right, you would inherit your grandmother's frying pan. And so I love that, you know, all this crusty history was on that. Mm-hmm. And then I just kind of carved these different size breasts and put them on them, and kind of, you know, I kind of saw them as sort of, you know, an American kind of tribute to women in terms of nurturers and feeders and providers and protectors. So
it's fabulous. And actually, this plays on an earlier work that you did with frying pans, but where there were portraits of women's faces that were painted on the underside. Were they painted?
On the backside. Yeah. And they were there are portraits of domestic workers, so, you know, housekeepers, cooks, nannies, and that they were done in really dark oils. And I remember one time I said, oh, go to my studio. It's open. You can go look at it. This is at a residency. And they came back and said, yeah, I went by your studio, but there's just a bunch of frying pans hanging on the wall. And the notion was that these were members in the household that were invisible, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, they would come in, you know, especially like these nannies that would, you know, get the kids out of bed and feed them and take them to school and pick them up from school, you know, clean the house in between, and then feed them and bathe them sometimes and tuck them in. Mm. And then, you know, as soon as the kid reaches a certain age, it is completely cut off. And so all of those parts were just, you know, first name basis, that there was no sort of consideration of those workers' families. Yeah. Many of them had left their children, you know, in the islands. When I was in New York, that would be the case. Most of them had families that were, you know, left behind. And so someone else was taking care of their children while they took care of other people's children so they could send money back so that their children could have food to eat.
They're very powerful. Very powerful. And then this is just such an amazing next step in that series, which, you know, with the focus on the breasts. The breasts are so important in Luba art as well. And if a woman is not busy upholding the platform of a throne that is the seat of power in Luba culture is not a subservient image, but rather the image of woman as the foundation of mm-hmm. kingship, then otherwise you would see women gesturing to their breasts. And this isn't just in Luba art. You might see this in Yoruba art, a sign of deference to the gods or the spirits. Mm-hmm. But in Luba culture, I was told by some of the people with whom I worked that it was also that women held the secrets of Luba royalty within their breasts. Ooh, and so it was not only fertility, but it went further than that. That the nurturing and the fertility of and the ability of women to bring children into the world was also a reason why a woman's body could become a receptacle of spiritual power and energy. Right. Yeah. So it's a beautiful pipe that where That's a woman is both surmounting and supporting elements of this otherwise functional object, like a frying pan, right?
Or
like
hammer.
One of Allison's monumental works, where we're also looking at a precarious study and balance here.
Yeah, this piece is called Cool Maman. It's sort of, I did two sculptures that were sort of paying tribute to Yoruba deities that I felt were really important to my sanity and safety. One of them was Smokin' Papa Shode, which was giving thanks to Ogun, being a carver and working with a chainsaw. I felt it was really important that he knew I was, you know, rooting for him so he'd watch my back and still have all my digits. And then the other one, Yemaya, who, you know, has come over to the Americas via Africa, but that she, you know, is the goddess of the seas, but she also is cooling and has patience and nurturing and creativity. Mm. And I felt that these were tools that I really needed help with, especially as a practicing artist and a mother. Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, she has this pillar of all of these white vessels, and her colors are white and blue, and these are all kind of receptacles for water and fluids. But it's also that, you know, this pillar connects her to the heavens, and that almost like a post where the spirits can come down and mingle with us here on this plane. But also just, you know, that she's physically kind of balancing this thing, which I don't know, for those of you out there, working moms out there, that's what it is, you know, right? We're trying to like keep all these, you know, plates up in the air at the same time and not drop any of them or drop babies in between sort of things. So this was really important. So they're back, you know, these two posts. So, Smokin' Papa Shode has a stack of iron implements like frying pans and chains and scythes and sickles. More tools, which I think this is great. Yeah.
It reminds me so much of this great Yoruba Epa mask, because this mask that is worn by a very strong young man, it weighs probably 70 pounds, represents the mother of all. And so this is a mother of twins, but a mother of twins in Yoruba society stands for our mothers collectively, all of our mothers. Mm-hmm. And she's a mother of an entire community. But if you look at it, you can see she's also performing this balancing act. She's got these children, or they're actually quite adults, so we don't know if they're her children and are twins, or whether they're actual retainers, but there's this whole community that surrounds her and supports her, but that she is also supporting.
Right.
So
right.
there's a really beautiful resonance. And Yemaya, or Yemaja, as Allison was talking about, is the Yoruba goddess of the sea. So this is an instance where an aspect of African art and culture really kind of interpenetrate in your work.
Right. And I'm trying to remember where I read it or where I heard it, but, you know, that the power of Yemaya and the power of the water is that, you know, you think of the Grand Canyon, this massive thing that was carved by patience and steadfastness. I mean, sometimes, you know, so I really like that idea as well, that, you know, we can kind of move the world and change the world and shape the world through patience and nurturing. And I thought that was really beautiful.
Beautiful. So the thing is that we don't have an infinite amount of time
here. Sorry. We just get so involved in it. Yeah.
We just love to talk. But the thing is that all of the remainder of the images that you're going to see are, other than a couple of African ones, are going to take you on a trajectory now that I see in knowing you, Allison, and talking to you about your work as having some very powerful autobiographical dimensions. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can begin to tell us about how those images of nurturing and succulence and balance, albeit precarious, begin to take a different turn here.
Right, yeah. And I guess, you know, just having kids in the beginning really changed my work right away. I realized that there was this other world out there. And, you know, when you have this baby comes out and it's got a personality and everything is like, whoa, this is heavy. You know, you know, this thing, this being just came out of you and it's its own self sort of thing. So it really changed my work profoundly. And so these two pieces are really, you know, luckily she's not here, kind of reflecting my daughter, Maddie, who I think the first one I was away at Dartmouth and my mother, I was on a residency for 2 months, which was really difficult for me. And my mother sent me an image of Maddie, who was 10 at the time. And she was like in booty shorts and she had like her midriff out and she was like sticking her butt out and everything. And I'm just like, wanted like, you know, book the next plane back to Los Angeles. It's like, oh my God, adolescence, stop. So I did this piece called Rise, Sally, Rise. And it comes out of the children's song that we used to sing a lot when we were young, which is goes, little Sally Walker sitting in the saucer, rise, Sally, rise, wipe your weeping eyes, put your hands on your hip and let your backbone slip. And you shake it to the east and you shake it to the west, right? What? West, and you shake it to the wind that you love the best. And, you know, it was just a sassy street song. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was always totally kind of perplexed why she was crying until I had the distance of a mother looking at their adolescent daughter going through all of that and how it's a one crying fest after another. And, you know, kind of it's about being in between these two worlds. And so I really see this piece as the metamorphosis of Maddie is what
this
I should call
it. The one on the left
it.
That
yeah,
you're talking about?
Yeah, where she's kind of bent over. And she actually doesn't even have a face because I didn't really know who she was. But she's obviously a young woman who's too large for a child's chair. Mm. And, you know, I joke that it would be nice if adolescents could be, if we could take our cues from the insect world and adolescents could be spent in a cocoon. And, you know, just put them in a closet, lock them up, and then, you know, they come out beautiful little butterflies sort of thing. So, you know, I guess I was kind of preparing for the onslaught of, you know, the struggle of dealing with that. And then the other piece, Brood, was really kind of, you know, simultaneously, and sorry, this kind of gets a little graphic, guys, but, you know, when I became menopausal and my daughter then, you know, started menstruating, and so it was kind of like this passing of the baton of fertility. Mm-hmm. And so this is, you know, a stack of children's chairs, so she's, you know, too big for these chairs, and they're all kind of precariously assembled, and again, she's kind of on this bizarre balance, and what she's doing is she's breaking open pomegranates and eating them, mm-hmm. and the pomegranate juice runs down her chin and her chest and down between her legs. Mm-hmm. And then there's all these spent pomegranates on the bottom, and it's called Brood. And the idea, you know, at once being broody and moody, mm-hmm. but also brood as being a place where nesting starts to happen and things like that as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, pomegranates became an important element of your work in this period of
time. You know, some people think of them as actually the original forbidden fruit that, right. you know, and when you open them that, you know, they're full of seeds and they look very ovarian-like sort of thing. So.
And then we get to the issue of baggage, right?
Excess baggage. So, you know, this is the threat, right? So this is like, you know, if you guys don't shape up, you know, I'm sitting here with these big pair of scissors and I'm going to cut it all loose sort of thing. And it wasn't only about cutting loose my children, but I think it was also cutting loose that baggage of the work I've done before and kind of wanting to kind of move on to new ideas. And, you know, there's that kind of odd point for an artist where you have a certain amount of success with a certain, you know, imagery. Mm-hmm. And then you start to abuse that imagery.
Yeah.
And this was trying to give myself the license to cut that loose and start anew, which leads us to the next slide.
So this is really you.
Yeah. You know, threatening. And then this is maybe a more extreme threat, but still it was just a threat. And this is called Proclamation, where, you know, the braid has been cut. It's been nailed on the wall. It's cast bronze, but I made it by taking a rope apart and then braiding it back so that braid is actually like 15 feet long, and then we cast it into bronze. So, you know, again, it was this sort of idea. And
By this time, were your kids still at home?
They're still at home.
They're still.
This is kind of like showing them the door, right? And then this is like, no, don't go yet, sort of thing. So this piece is called Sea of Nectar. And the title comes from the names of Galileo's seas on the moons. And they're just so beautiful and poetic. And so I really love the, I think, Sea of Nectar, Sea of Fecundity, yeah. Sea of Serenity. Mm. I forget what the other one is. But but this kind of switches a little bit, because I think part of our education, what was wonderful about our education at Scripps yeah. is that, you know, we were really hammered with humanities.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Simela on one hand, and then, you know, Greek and Roman
exactly.
mythology, that, you know, I kind of merged those things together. And it was just, yeah. you know, such a rich amount of material to mix up and play with. And mm-hmm. so this is stirring up those two things. And so mm-hmm. this is the story of Demeter and Persephone. And so this is Demeter kind of mourning the loss of her daughter Persephone, who was, you know, kidnapped and taken into the underworld. And so she's expressing milk. And again, for those of us who've nursed children and, you know, like if you've been kept away from them so much and you're like, feel like you're going to explode, this is that explosion. And so in her grief, you know, she's just exploding milk, and it's pouring out in, you know, torrents and seeping into the ground and eventually filtering down to Persephone in the underworld.
Mm. What is it made of?
So she's carved out of, I should say, you know, most of the figures are carved out of wood. I used to put together found wood when I lived in New York, but now I just go to Home Depot and put together some wood, and then I carve them with chainsaws, and then I cover them. In this case, she's covered with sealing tin. Mm-hmm. And then those are actual branches that we made molds of that have been cast in bronze. So so that's how the... And this brings us up pretty much to date.
This is in the exhibition in Venice at the L.A. Louvre Gallery.
Right.
And it's called...
Sloth or Sloth?
The exhibition is called Sloth. Sloth. And this piece is called Mambi, but Mambi. The other name for her is?
Is Thistle and Twitch, which comes from Homer's Ovid, and again going back to Persephone and so and Demeter. And so I don't know if you can
this
really
see This is a huge piece, it. By the way.
Yeah, she's about 8 feet tall, and she's hollow. She's layers and layers and layers of paper. And then in between some of those layers are painted brambles, and then layers of paper on top. So it's almost like a tattoo under the skin. And so at first glance, it looks like, you know, looks like you've got old lady transparent skin syndrome like myself, where you can see your veins or varicose veins. But then when you look a little closer, you can see that they have thorns and they're all brambled. And then she kind of beckons you to come in and do some navel gazing. And you peer inside of her navel, and you see inside of that is a world of brambles and thistles and thorns. And the story being that, and the title coming, Thistle and Twitch, that, you know, when she lost Persephone, she lost all interest in her duties as, you know, the goddess of the harvest, and all fields became fallow. And Thistle and Twitch grew up, and brambles took over the fields. And so it talks, you know, simultaneously about, you know, the loss of my daughter, who has now gone away to college, but also, you know, that loss of fertility and that loss of that role as a mother. And so, you know, it's kind of like fallow field within myself.
Mm. It's an amazing piece when you go up close to it and you bend down to look inside her belly button, her arms wrap around you. It's very, very powerful. And there's this kind of play of visuality, because her eyes look empty, as many of your sculptures' eyes do, and yet our eyes can peer inside to this world within. And it reminds me of the writer Susan Stewart, who's a cultural studies scholar, who talks a lot about the fact that we can never really know ourselves except through the gaze of others. We can never know ourselves in our entirety. We see ourselves in the mirror backwards. We can only ever see sort of ourself in partiality. And so there's this really nice play with this piece that
you're...
first of all, where is she looking? And the fact that we are able to look inside of her.
Inside of her, yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned to me that the empty eyes in your pieces set these works apart, as if in another world from all of us who gaze upon them.
Right. I mean, and, you know, her title, Mombi, you know, is just kind of like she's in this other plane. And I think because a lot of the figures that, you know, as viewers, again, going back to the voyeurs, that we are kind of like scrutinizing them and we're somehow trying to understand her story, maybe not necessarily with her permission or their permission. Mm-hmm. And so they're always kind of looking out, you know, into this other world, or they're in trance-like sort of situations, but, you know, that we're not necessarily there together with them at the same time. So
we're going to
run through these. Sorry.
We're going to go through the. Is it okay to continue a few more minutes?
Yeah, but we just want to save time for questions.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So I think a lot of these are in the show. This one is in the show right now.
Right, right.
Very nice piece because it incorporates glass, which has been one of the materials that Allison's been working with.
Right, really interested in recently. I started with doing glass with Pilchek, and then these were pieces that were done as a result of a residency I did in New Orleans, which also kind of came to the idea that the title Slough was, you know, one about, and, you know, sloughing off skin and sloughing off old identities, but it was also about, you know, the mire and the landscape of New Orleans. So there's, you know, it being, you know, wetlands. Mm. So she's basically this glass head that has brambles stuck up her nose, basically. And so she's got like these brambles within her head that you can see.
And she's called Brambling Blues.
Brambling Blues, right. And then this was a piece, an older piece, but it, from the show I had at Otis called Still, which I think we'll have the catalog later today. And she's sitting again on this chair, kind of up and out of the way, but she has this umbilical cord that comes down, and it's called Undone, and it's kind of, I was saying it's like an aborting, but it's almost like a miscarriage of ideas and desires and dreams.
Mm-hmm. Here's a detail.
So here's a detail. So within that, coming off of this, you know, umbilical cord that's coming out from between her legs, are these bottles that are bound and kind of have these sort of, you know, unknown sort of secrets and desires and things that she wasn't able to act upon. So,
in reference to your life as a mother, as an artist,
yeah,
as
things you put on the back burner, things you abandon.
And then where does that lead us? We come to these ethereal figures in your work recently, almost ghost-like.
Yeah.
Also going back to this idea of veiling. Mm-hmm. And this partial visuality and knowability. What are we seeing here?
Well, what we're not seeing is a bronze figure that's, you know, very meticulously has scarification all over her. Mm. But, you know, again, you're not supposed to know that. So, you know, she has this veil, and it's called Pallor Tricks. And I think, again, it goes, you know, the inspiration of the idea really goes about comes about, you know, appearing to be white and having this black heritage and, you know, only my black ankles are showing sort of thing. But it also, I think in light of this other show, where I'm really starting to talk about these skins and these kind of layers of identity and almost invisibility. So she almost kind of takes on this sort of ghost persona as well, that she's kind of cloaked and invisible, even though she is visible, but who she really is not visible.
Mm. I'm going to skip. This is a priestess also, veil.
Like concealed stuff, yeah.
I'm going to skip a couple of those, just bring you to the last few here.
Yeah.
Shorn. This is on display in the L.A. Louvre.
Right.
Very powerful piece.
And so all of that hair
such
that
defiance.
I've accumulated all these years, I just cut it all off. And you can't, I don't know if you can see, but she's holding a large piece of glass. And so she's basically cut all of her hair off and even cut her pubic hair off. And it's wrapped around her feet. And on one hand, it's kind of like ridding ourselves of that weight and kind of cutting ourselves free of that weight. But at the same time, it's a mourning of that. And I know in a lot of cultures, you'll shave your head in mourning and to cut all of that away. And so it's somewhere between that. And I think, you know, that, you know, my family and my children have been my ballast in a lot of ways. But So that kind of cutting off and that loss and that cutting free is sort of bittersweet because I have a freedom to become something else, but at the same time, I don't have that grounding. So
right, which really comes forth
us to this
in this piece,
girl.
Milk teeth.
I guess this is what happens when you do shed your skin, and she's kind of like this frightening, scary sort of fleshy thing. The idea came from one of my kids' chairs, and I had noticed that they had basically gnawed the back of it off. And so I was really intrigued with kind of like when you do shed your skin and you do shed that identity, who do you become? And you have to kind of learn who you are all over again. So she is basically teething on the furniture. She's that id. She's that monster within ourselves that we don't really want to recognize. So, you know, this is my new self-portrait.
But we wanted to actually leave with just a series of four bronze works that are really about the seasons of the soul, in a sense.
Right. And I think it's nice to end with these because they talk really about a cycle. So what I did, this is for Madison Square Park in New York City, and they commissioned me to make four bronze sculptures. So they're all 8 feet tall, and they each represent the seasons, but also the seasons of a woman's maturity. So this is summer, so she's pregnant, and inside of that belly are electronic fireflies that fire on and off. And then this is fall, so she is, you know, postmenopausal, desperately trying to gather all those pomegranates that are dropping to the ground, so there are all these blown pomegranates. And then this is winter, and from the back she just looks like a stone, and then when you come around the front you see it's a figure that's all curled up. And then the last one is back to spring again. So, and that's adolescence, and hope springs eternal.
So we're gonna stop conversing now.
Sorry, we get carried away. Thank you.
But we want to open it up to questions. I know you must have many for Allison. And there are mics being passed around the room. So let's start with this gentleman.
Hi. In the early part of this discussion, there were two women, one in the bath standing in a bowl, and the other one, I think it was Sassy, standing on
broken glass. Soup bang, right.
Uh-huh. So the question that I have is, was there one event in your life that was painful that brought this thing of pain and overcoming pain on, or was it a series of events in your life that...
I have had the misfortune of having a very happy, nurturing childhood. You know, all my friends were like pissed off at their parents, and I actually really loved my parents and I loved my home. But at the same time, I could see all those that were suffering, and I think maybe having that very privileged life made me really feel and experience that pain in a way that was really intensified because I was fortunate and I realized that, you know, some of it's just the luck of the draw. A lot of it is political. And, you know, so a lot of that work really is responding to the world out there and sort of my empathy for those that have suffered. But I have to say I've had really great fortune.
Let's take another question here.
My question goes back to the first sculpture that you showed as well, the woman who is bathing. And, you know, like, as a bather, for me, I'm thinking of, like, the tradition of painting bathers. And you did mention its similarity to Gauguin's work. Mm-hmm. And so my question generally goes along the lines of, like, a primitivist kind of critique.
Right.
But what I'm asking is that if a lot of your work, I'm only talking about the sculptures that were shown at the beginning, mm-hmm. that seem, at least for me, to sort of conceptually appropriate like African objects to kind of, you know, breathe in the logic to like the way that you would sculpt the forms for, you know, for your sculptures. And it kind of suggested a kind of like a personality or a person. And so for me, what's happening with that is that we begin to understand this person in terms of materiality. And so like the way that they're sculpted, the way that the surface appears begins to become the way that we understand them. Mm-hmm. And with the woman who's like has the open breast and she mm-hmm. sort of like challenges a kind of voyeurism, to me it's similar to like Valley Export's work where she lets people touch her breast and she confronts the gaze. And it's very confrontational. But with this work though, when you open the breast, you get like jewels and there's like passion. It's kind of a discovery. So mm-hmm. I guess what I'm just laying these things out to sort of ask you what you think about them. Do you think that your work kind of deals with that same kind of appropriation that, you know, is seen as problematic and is seen as a kind of primitivism?
Well, I think specifically, and especially like Gauguin, who was, you know, painting natives and this sort of colonial sort of view of the other as, you know, you know, naive and voluptuous and, you know, nubile and all of that. It was definitely a criticism of that. So, yeah.
Ooh, we have a question in the back.
Thank you so much for sharing your work. You're such an inspiration. There's a piece I want to ask you about that you did that was kind of a statement about apartheid and with the South African miner, and it really impacted me because, I mean, I was an activist, but your piece provoked me to realize that that wasn't enough, that we actually, through our the way our lifestyle is and the way that we buy things and all that impacts people, you know, in other places. Can you talk about that piece?
That was one of the few pieces that was very much removed from, you know, my personal experience and my own personal. It was really an article that I'd read. You know, it was, you know, this horrific mining conditions, and the mine had blown up, and all these miners were killed. And, you know, it's interesting in terms of, you know, activism and whether art can be activism. So in a way, it's kind of nice to hear that the piece somehow, you know, does have some sort of power out there. Because sometimes as artists, you know, we're like fiddling in our studios and making these things, and we're just like, you know, what are we doing? We should just be out there doing other things. So, you know, it was just something that I really felt strongly about. And so it's basically a figure, and he's got wings that are bound, I think, and he's kind of really sort of tarred, so it's kind of like this sort of charred angel sort of thing, because I think many of them died from a result of a fire. But so yeah, there are works that really respond politically to things sort of outside of beyond my own experience, and I'm just really moved to kind of comment, and hopefully comment on them in a way that's poetic and not didactic, that, you know, bring people to kind of think about, you know, what is going on, and really, you know, what we can do in whatever way we can handle to somehow alleviate those conditions that extend outside and within our country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, we have a question here.
Hi.
Thank you for your life. But what are the Luba doing today? Because in the Congo, what's happening with them?
I'm sorry, what are they doing today?
What's happening with the culture today? Because life is so different.
I know. Well, first of all, one of our students who is in the audience, Elaine, raise your hand. One of our UCLA graduate students was just there this summer in Lubumbashi, which is the regional capital. As many of you know, Congo has endured a very horrific civil war for more than 20 years now. It's primarily affecting eastern Congo. Luba are located in southeastern Congo. They are not quite in the hot seat of it all, but certainly have been somewhat affected. Nevertheless, we are very close with a Luba professor at Northridge who has been very involved in the exhibition at LACMA, Shaping Power, Dr. Mutombo Nkulu Nsenga. He just returned from a year's sabbatical right in the Luba heartland. And he makes it very clear that despite the difficulties that people have endured over these years, that life goes on. And a lot of the same kinds of ceremonies and worldview and art making and performance and you know, the ethos of being Luba are absolutely thriving. So there's this kind of paradox, and he's going to give a talk about this actually on October 7th at UCLA in the African Studies Center, this sort of humanism at the heart of it all. And he attributes it to Luba notions of personhood that are rooted in a concept called Muchima Muyampe, which means a good heart. And that to be a good king, you have to have a good heart if you want to ensure human flourishing for your people. And to be a good human being, you have to have a good heart. And this is really kind of the matrix of the philosophy that undergirds Luba culture. And I would say that that's why we see this remarkably thriving culture despite hardships and challenges that they've faced in these years, this entire last century. Yes.
Kiruki.
Oh my, I get to be the last question. You know, I have to say, this is almost a private question. I wonder if this is, I feel like I should
I've
be
already bared it all. Right?
I feel like I should be having this offline. So here goes. You know, you talk about the color in your work, and it's not neutral. That it, you know, there's so many examples of how it represents race and skin. And I just, you know, I almost didn't ask this question, but I've just been so taken by that piece with the skillets, the frying pans that are also these breasts. And I'd love to hear you talk about whether you feel that that might represent this universal concept of a woman's breast, or is it really a Black woman's breast?
I think it's universal. I mean, you know, I'm coming out of, you know, my family and my experience, and, you know, I don't know whether the skillet culture extends beyond my family sort of experience, so I don't know how much of that is shared. But I think, and I think, you know, again, going back to the granary doors, that it's really talking about this sort of universal idea of women as being these nurturers and, you know, providing so much beyond milk and all of these things. So I guess it is kind of beyond that, but, you know, it all stems from sort of my own experience. So whether it's read by folks outside of Black culture the same way, I'm not sure. So I don't know. Thank you.
Okay, I think we're going to wrap up. Yes. I'm sure you have many more questions. I'm sure you'll have a chance to talk to Allison. Deeping. But thank you so much for coming tonight.
Thank you for coming.
Wonderful audience.
Great.
Allison, thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.